Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
Oh, when he wore.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
He washed my sins away. Happy day.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to learn how grape juice can increase antioxidant intake without causing high blood sugar or uric acid. Published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Nutrition Research, done at the University of Santa Catarina, which is in Brazil. We have about 12 other important stories, all from peer-reviewed journals, all at respected institutions, all showing you how to live a longer and healthier life. Also today, we're going to give you a talk-back segment. It's an article I read yesterday from Global Comment, and it's an article that the title is Why Climate Change is an Irrelevance, Economic Growth is a Myth, and Sustainability is 40 Years Too Late by Kevin Casey. Once I read it, I'd like for you to call in and give your points of view. Our talkback number is 888-874-4888. Also today, I have several items we're going to go to, including over the holidays, they were promoting a festival about chitlins and why they were so good and tasty. Really? Well, I'm going to share a different point of view, but it's not me going to share it. I have three audio clips I found that tell a better story than I could. And then after you hear this and watch it, you can watch, by the way, our clips as well. You may rethink having one of these cultural foods. We begin with the latest on health and healing. In a study published just this week, it suggests that grapes or grape juice could increase your antioxidant defenses without increasing your blood sugar or your uric acid levels. Now, grape varieties and cultivation conditions influence the bioactive polyphenols in grapes, and the fox grape variety is cultivated in tropical regions and traditionally used to make grape juice. It's known to be a rich source of polyphenols, which promote health. Researchers who were from the Federal University of Santa Catarina in Brazil examined the effects of short-term consumption of organic and conventional juices made from fox grapes on antioxidant biomarkers in healthy people. They hypothesized that polyphenols that we talk about all the time from blueberries and raspberries, goji berries and pomegranates, and from tropical grape juice would improve redox homeostasis, which plays a role in fighting oxidative stress that I talked about on our last program. And so that's what they did, and they found that there was a substantial benefit to the people using it. Did not increase their blood sugar, did not increase your gas levels, it also helped them overall with all the reduction in oxidative stress. So one more reason to eat grapes, drink grape juice, or to have grape concentrate. From Bournemouth University in the United Kingdom comes a study about Tai Chi, Tai, T-A-I, Chi, C-H-I. It brings benefits for people with dementia. Now, the university research has found that Tai Chi is very good. They did a trial. They looked at the benefits of Tai Chi, especially with people who had advanced dementia, and they found that Tai Chi could help prevent falls and improve quality of life. One more reason to use this, and also if you have someone who has dementia or Alzheimer's, I suggest that once a week, Qigong also can help And I won't go into Qigong now, but it's important. It's a therapy where individuals have mastered the art, and not everyone can do it. It's not something you can teach people how to use their own energy to enhance a person who's sick's energy. Anyhow, this other study was published in Clinical Interventions in Aging, a major journal. So, once again, something involving energy medicine proven by quality research and published in peer-reviewed literature shows that it works. From Virginia Polytechnic Institute, published in the Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine, comes a study about a healthy diet boosting the positive outcomes of Qigong and Tai Chi. By the way, I'm a big advocate of Qigong. I've seen it work. I've seen it when I was filming How to De-Stress Naturally about 12 years ago. I was filming New York City's best-known Qigong expert, and I was watching him work on someone, a person I had taken. See, he had never met them, didn't know what was wrong with him, and he was able just to move his hands about 4 inches over the person's body and immediately focus in and said, the person has this, and that was correct. So then I wanted to see what it would be like. I'd never had Qigong myself, so I laid down, and he put his hand over my heart, and he smiled, and suddenly I could feel a heat. I mean a real, real authentic heat where the body temperature in that area goes way up. So what they can do with this energy is just wonderful. And anyhow, this is about a diet, starting off with a healthy diet. And what they found was that when they have a healthy diet, which is principally a plant-based diet, and they use Tai Chi and Qigong, one enhances the other. So there's a greater synergistic effect. So that's good. And that works. And also with Qigong and Tai Chi, you can use breathing techniques and guided imagery, meditation and postures that you would use in yoga, all working together synergistically. Then we have a study from Arizona State University about caring for family is what motivates people worldwide. Across the globe, caring for loved ones is what matters most. But for decades, this has not been the focus of many social psychology studies. So an international team of researchers led by evolutionary and social psychologists from Arizona State University surveyed 7,000 people from 27 different countries about what motivates them. And the findings go against 40 years of research. This study will be coming out next week in Perspectives on Psychological Sciences. People consistently rated kin care or family care and mate retention as the most important motivations in their lives. And we found this over and over and over in all 27 countries that participated. So, and these are diverse countries from Australia to Bulgaria to Thailand to Uganda, covered all the continents. And so that's important. Now, back in the 1970s, I had met with, about 1971, I had met with a family that were the Emir's family of Hunzikut and the Hunzas. And they were concerned about the planned road that would be built through part of Hunza connecting India and China. And they thought that their civilization would be adversely affected, which it was. It had been rather secluded for over 2,000 years. It was originally founded by those who abandoned Alexander the Great's quest and escaped up into this beautiful, pristine valley. And they went elevated up to about 10 to 12,000 feet. That's high. And they spent hours talking about what it was like to live there, where you had to wait till you were 31 before you could get married. There were no jails because there were no crimes. There was no currency because they simply exchanged everything and shared everything. So nobody went hungry. But they would fast frequently in the spring because some of the crops had not yet come up at the lower levels. And so they learned intermittent fasting. And they started their day with all these very healthy items that they had stored over the winter, like dried mulberries and dried apricots and dried figs. And they would put this into goat's milk, and that was their meal for much of the time. In any case, I did what I could. I had them on my radio show and promoted their concept, but that was an effort that was with no value, because at the end of the day, the trade between the two countries are what mattered. And over a period of time, I kept in touch with them. Their culture was adversely affected. They also were the longest-lived people in the world and had the least disease. He showed me photographs of people over 100 years of age playing polo on ponies. And in this country, you couldn't get a 100-year-old on a pony, let alone have them ride it. One bounce, and they're suddenly about 20 feet away in a hedge. So it was an interesting perspective. But when I was talking to them about what's the most important thing in your life, he said, our families, caring for one another. So then I went from there down to South America, to Europe, to the mountains. Everywhere I went over a five-year period taking these trips, I found that not everything they did was healthy. In some countries like in Italy and France, there's a lot of smoking. None of them, not a single one I went to in the world, took any supplements. They didn't drink juices, but they also were conscious of functional foods and herbs in ways that no American was. And so they did care about their diet. They did care about having natural apothecaries, so whatever they needed, they had someone in their midst who could help them. And so when I came back, I was sitting at the institute, and the director came up one day, said, we haven't seen you in the last week. I said, no. I said, I'm concerned about what I found. And he said, what's that? I said, well, I was speaking with Larry, and it was Lawrence Lachan, one of America's greatest scientists, and he came up with some remarkably good insights into how people develop cancer, including breast cancer and arthritis, based upon being unappreciated. And I said, I'd like to speak with him and you together. And I also called up Dr. Abram Hoffer, who, along with Linus Pauling, both were friends, founded the first orthomolecular medical society in the world. And then I would later share this with George Borgstrom, Renaud Dubow, Buckminster Fuller, a whole lot of heady people. And then I was friends with Carmi Harari, Martin Shepard, Perlmutter, Albert Ellis, Donald Mullen, Elaine Kahn. These were all psychologists, and some were psychiatrists and medical doctors. But it was a very heady group. And I laid out over a period of 2 weeks this idea. What if everything we've been told gives us health in America is wrong? It's only half truth. They said, what do you mean? And I said, well, I'm meeting people around the world who've never taken a vitamin, who don't go out and do exercise the way we do at all. You don't see them burning off that anxiety every night, you know, for an hour on a treadmill in a gym. They're not working themselves to death. They're not careerists. But they do live longer lives, and what's most importantly, they're actually happy. And I was seeing a lot of people who were not happy. They were wealthy or successful or careerist, but they weren't happy. And that's where I developed the concept that you cannot be healthy if you're not happy. So the foundation of health is happiness. And then I said what they believe in, and it came to me when I was sitting in a home that was 800 years old, by the way, and you had that old wood smell of an Italian family in the Italian Alps. And I was at my buddies and my brothers and a little Jeep behind me, and I was running, and I would run about 26 miles a day, or a marathon each day, through the Italian Alps. And you could tell a village before you saw it because of the smells early in the morning. The smell of fresh baked bread. And we would pull up, and there might be anywhere from 6 to 12 homes in a hamlet. And then you'd go another mile or two, there'd be another one. And this is the way it went on for hundreds of miles. And they all knew each other. And some of these homes, the same lineage of family, generation after generation, have lived there for 500, 600, 700, 800 years. And you could not ask for more warm-hearted, wonderful people than those I met in these different farming communities or rural communities. And the Italians, well, they came right over, and I was very thin because I was running marathons. And she gave me a loaf of this bread. Now, I didn't eat wheat, and I didn't eat bread. But my buddy, who spoke fluent Italian because he's from Italy, he says, he's a medical doctor, he says, try it. Because they just harvested the wheat, ground it with a stone ground, and added olive oil. It's got all the ingredients. So I tried it. Nothing happened, meaning no allergic reaction. And that's where I began to look at not just the fact that something was a wheat, but how was it grown? And then I found out that frequently we're allergic to things that are done in the processing or adding to a natural product, like an apple. For years, I didn't eat apples because my nose would get inflamed, my cheeks would get inflamed, and my ears would get inflamed. Typical allergy. But then when I ate some organic apples upstate, nothing happened. Went back into the city the next day, had an apple, same thing happened. One was sprayed, the other was not. In any case, that afternoon, they didn't speak English, but my friend said, this person is an organic farmer. He teaches organic farming in the United States. He's also a cook, a chef. He would like for you to give him some work to do. He'll help you with whatever you want to do. And in return, he'd like over lunch just to have an opportunity to talk with you about your life. And they agreed to it. They thought it was funny because they'd never seen an American wanting to work, right? Americans don't work. That's not what we're referring to. But when you're traveling, you're generally as a tourist. And you're not looking to get out there and climb up and down the sides of hills with people who are 90 years old. And that's exactly what was happening. But at this lunch, what was unique was I was watching the oldest couple, and they were dancing like Fred Astaire and Eleanor Powell. Pure magic, the energy going between them, and smiles and laughter and holding hands. And they don't have short lunches. They have a lunch that lasts about 2 hours. And they take their time, they discuss issues. Everything is brought up that needs to be brought up. And then they rest and relax afterwards before they go back to work, generally around 4 p.m. In any case, every generation was sitting at the same long table, and I could see it. And I asked them, what's the most important thing in your life? And she looks at me and she says, look across the table. The most important thing in my life is that wonderful person looking back at me. Okay. I found that was true down in Jamaica. When I would go up near the Blue Mountains or go off the beaten path, get out of Ocho Rios, go get out of Negril, get out of Montego Bay, get out of Kingston and go into the country. Same thing. You see people walking, holding hands. They're enjoying each other, the quality of relationship. And when I talk to them about transitions in life and death and dying, none of this was frightening to them. And because there was always someone to care for you. There was always someone who loved you. There was always someone there for your first breath and your last breath. I thought, that's my answer. So to these friends of mine, who were all very innovative and intellectually gifted, I put it forward, what if we had it in reverse? That we think that you have to become a careerist and succeed and achieve and be acknowledged, then you'll have the time for your relationships and for petting the dog and cat and spending time for those nice walks or visiting other places in the world, when it's just the opposite, that we should not have destinations. We should only have a journey. And if we get stuck in our journey thinking that somehow we're too comfortable to continue it, we just want to stay in this comfort zone, that we're actually receding back. And in life, what you don't use, you lose by degrees. It's on a curve. Our intellect, our creativity, our capacity to feel and love, express, you have to use it. And I saw everywhere in the world I went, people were using it. And so that's what I share with my friends. And I said, so that's why they're living a longer life, because they're happy. And they're happy because they're grounded in a belief that combines both the uniqueness of being with the awe of the larger spiritual energies of life, which all these people all over the world were connected to. And some of my friends accepted, some thought no. But today, ask anybody I counsel, and I only counsel terminally ill people, ask them, what does Gary share first? A supplement, exercise, a diet, juicing? No. Nope. I did 55 lectures that just finished yesterday with our anti-aging group, the first group. I have another one starting this Monday because there were seven people who came late, and so therefore they have another month or 2 months to go. But of the 55 lectures I did, only two were on health. Two. 53 lectures had to deal with life issues, identity issues. Who are we? What do we value? Where do we get our messages? How powerful are the conditioned responses that create a defense mechanism around us, a hypersensitive bubble that we live into, versus being free and open? So just want to share that with you, because I think that until we understand that you first have to create a foundation in order to build something, otherwise, no matter how wonderful you build something, a career or a relationship, if it's not built in a solid way, it's like building the Taj Mahal in quicksand. It sinks. And what you neglect will also atrophy until one day it withers and dies on the vine. And then and only then we've lost something do we think, wow, how foolish was I when everything was there to harmonize and I chose to do something else instead. That's why if you're going to have a pet, give it attention every day, because the day will come when it's not there. And you don't want to live with remorse and guilt and shame that I made everything else more important than my health. I gave every excuse and resisted anything that was good for me because I was overly responsible for everyone else's needs long after they should have taken on their own responsibility. Something to think about. Anyhow, Beijing and Shanghai universities has a study about crab apples. Yeah, crab apples. Remember those little ugly things that tasted bitter and you spit them out? Well, it turns out they could help cut your cholesterol. Now, this is an important study, and a lot of people have hypercholesterolemia, and that leads to atherosclerosis, and that leads to heart disease. It can also lead to diabetes, muscle pain, liver damage, and other side effects. The treatments are very, very, toxic. But the crab apple has long been used for the treatment of diarrhea and indigestion, other digestive diseases in traditional Chinese medicine, very rich in antioxidants. And in America, we don't eat them. But according to this study, they are very powerful at lowering triglycerides, lowering LDL, and raising HDL. So just a good thing. So look for crabberry extracts. From McGill University, high-fat diets proven to fuel prostate cancer, and that's not good. So for all of you who, genes called oncogenes, some genes are called oncogenes, play a role in cancer initiation and progression. And in this particular scientific paper, they found that when people are on a high-fat diet, they were far more likely to end up with prostate cancer. So the American diet, the average American diet, is a high-fat diet. It's a dangerous diet. It's an irresponsible diet. So get off all those fats. Now, coconut oil, olive oil, flaxseed oil, hemp oil, those are good fats. don't use the canola oil and the other processed clarified oils. Finally, from GreenMed Info comes a study about how black cohosh, that's C-O-H-O-S-H, is better than Prozac for menopause. Now, menopause in and of itself should not be pathologized. It is a normal transition in a woman and andropause in men, where the amount of free testosterone, total testosterone in men, and the amount of estrogen and progesterone are adversely affected. They diminish. That doesn't mean you lose all capacity to create estrogen. You don't. But a lot of people, when they're going through menopause, they feel fear or they worry that, you know, it's going to be really bad. And antidepressants and hormone synthetic treatments are the popular prescriptions, but they can be deadly. Now, they did research on the black cohosh, and it helps reverse hot flashes, night sweats, and it can help with balancing out estrogen and progesterone. It's a natural antidepressant, and it also, remember, when you medicate menopause, you increase your risk of cancer, cardiovascular disease, stroke, and dementia. That's what you get with the traditional therapies. So natural hormone rebalancing is good. Vitex and black cohosh are examples of what you can do to help. And Wake Forest School of Medicine says aerobic exercise preserves brain volume and improves cognitive function. Yep, I fully agree. You should exercise 5 days a week for an hour, and that can make all the difference in the world. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, I'm going to do a commentary, and I want you to respond to it. And our talkback number is 888-874-4888. The commentary is by Kevin Casey from Global Comment, and the article is entitled Why Climate Change is an Irrelevance, Economic Growth is a Myth, and Sustainability is 40 Years Too Late. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Oh, that reminds me of all the great parties, 55 parties over 40 years that we did together around New York. We filled up the biggest venues, the Red Parrot, the downtown, the Cheetah. Wow, so many times. And I am now going over the next month to edit all those home movies that everyone sent to me, about 40 of them. So you can see yourself. I'm going to do a timeline from the very first one right up till 2 years ago. I'm going to do another one when I come back to do the premiere of my new environmental film in about 2 months. So I'll post that so you can all watch this. I don't know how long it's going to be, probably hours, but it'll be up on the internet. I'll let you know when it's there. In any case, this is from the article, quote, as someone who has been exploring the world's most isolated wilderness regions for nearly 50 years, I have some insights into the state of the planet and the human race's current environmental befuddlement. I've watched the condition of the Earth plummet before my eyes within my own lifespan to the extent that I no longer recognize it as the beautiful, diverse, supporter of all life it once was. So let me start by addressing a few key points of confusion that seem to affect both keen activists and head-in-the-sand deniers in equal measure. Climate change is not the biggest threat to the world's environment. We are. The world's rivers and seas aren't choked with floating piles of rubbish, toxic chemicals, and plastic waste because of climate change. They're They're that way because we have 7.7 billion people crammed onto a planet that's dying under the pressure of our greedy, selfish abuse. 2 decades from now, the Earth's oceans are on target to contain more plastic in them by weight than fish. Climate change didn't do that. We, way too many people, did that. Climate change hasn't covered the world with concrete or replaced healthy ecosystems with canal estates and shopping malls. We and our ever-increasing number are the culprit. Climate change is only one of many symptoms of an out-of-control disease, human overpopulation. The irreversible environmental damage stemming from having too many people on a finite planet is already painfully evident. Our bloated population is diminishing our children's futures in ways that we have little to do with the planet's temperature. I keep hearing people say, quote, humans have always found a way to solve difficult problems, so don't worry, it'll all work itself out. Alas, the problem the Earth faces now is one it has never dealt with before, a plague of nearly 8 billion humans it can't cope anymore. We've been so distracted making money, embracing our agendas, and spreading myths about growth and progress that we forgot to notice we've turned our only viable planetary home into a spherical garbage dump. Humans may be impressively intelligent, but they're also profoundly self-focused and short-sighted. No politician talks about our population epidemic. All you hear from them is jobs, 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 and more growth. You don't hear climate change activists talking about overpopulation either. It's that dangerous a subject, too painful a reality. It's permanently occupying the too hard basket of issues of life. Instead, we're all jumping on the global warming bandwagon. We stridently blame governments for lack of action on climate change while secretly hoping that whatever they decide to do doesn't adversely affect our consumer lifestyle. Let's not confuse activism with action. They're not the same. One is about social inclusion and feeling good about your outrage. The other is about doing something tangible to make things better. I hate to burst this old school bubble, but there's no longer such a thing as economic growth. Not in this century. There's no true sustainability either. Not anymore. The environmental tipping point everyone loves to talk about actually reached that at around 1980, when science tells us that humanity began to consume more of the Earth's resources than the planet could possibly regenerate. We've gobbled up more of our planet's resources in the past 50 years than in all previous human history combined, and polluted our way to prosperity in the process. Climate change had nothing to do with any of that, and it still doesn't. Economic growth needs population growth to sustain itself. But when a depleted planet can no longer carry the burden of an existing population and its endless demands, growth is nothing but a dangerous illusion. Today's healthy economy is tomorrow's dystopian misery. In this century, what we still mistakenly call economic growth is environmental destruction, pure and simple. Nothing we do today can be called sustainable on a planet that has already endured 4 solid decades of irreplaceable resource use. The 1970s were the last sustainable decade for humankind. Unfortunately, at the time, no one took notice that a tipping point had been reached and passed. Our current environmental woes have almost nothing to do with the climate and everything to do with how we've been treating the Earth, not just recently, but for many centuries. We've always abused the Earth, horribly managed it, and we've gotten away with it because our numbers weren't significant enough to cause lasting damage. Now our numbers are out of control, and that presents us with limited options. In hindsight, we should have addressed rampant overpopulation shortly after World War II, when the global population was still around 2.5 billion, less than a third of what it is today. But we were in the midst of a jubilant post-war optimism and still believed in the delusion of nature's endless bounty. If you could go back in time to around 1604, to the spot where Manhattan now sits, you would see a tiny settlement of about 150 people enjoying a pristine coastal wilderness with superb growing soil, ample wildlife, and rich timber forest, a genuine paradise on earth. Back then, whales would wander up the clean, fish-rich Hudson River, and you could pull lobsters out of the sea half as long as a person's leg. Huge flocks of passenger pigeons blackened the sky. Today, that same place is wall-to-wall concrete with one of the biggest human population densities on earth. We've been so busy improving things that we've destroyed practically everything. In the end, our legacy as a species won't be about all the wonderful things we've created while we've occupied the earth. It will be about all the wonderful things we've destroyed. The most astounding explosion of human population in history happened on my generation's watch, so we need to take ownership of that and the lack of foresight. Our own children are now paying the price for our blunders and have every right to be worried about the Earth's future and theirs. But let's not heap all the blame on baby boomers. Previous generations helped the planet's degradation along just as blindly, and today's young people still expect the sort of prosperous lifestyles that a dying planet can now only provide in the very short term. So I would patiently urge all climate change activists to direct their environmental concerns at those who really deserve it. They can start with the economists, developers, and politicians who blissfully believe that the status quo of perpetual growth still works. They can then move on to the religious zealots who still spout the mantra of man's dominion over nature and abhor the idea of contraceptions. After that, they can apportion a hefty dose of blame to the world's leaders who purposely sidestep the overpopulation issue like a political hot potato it is, despite the fact that it's killing our planet and robbing future generations of the spectacular biodiversity and viable ecosystems that older generations took for granted. And finally, they can look in the mirror and ask themselves what they are personally doing besides protesting in the streets to make their planet a better place for all life that dwells on it. What are the solutions to an overcrowded planet? Firstly, to stop getting sidetracked by the true climate change industry and recognize that the problem is our sheer numbers and blatant disregard for the planet's health, not the climate. We must replace political and economic agendas and warped ideologies with better education, especially in science. We need more global promotion of family planning, more female empowerment, and government incentives to have fewer children, not more. And sadly, we should have been proactive about all this stuff at least 60 years ago, instead of just waking up to our self-inflicted predicament now. While it's reassuring that today's young people are increasingly aware of the seriousness of their environmental plight, they are protesting up the wrong tree. They should direct their passion and attention to their real enemy, a greedy, arrogant, two-legged species that is in furious denial and has become far too adept at making excuses for the inexcusable. Okay, that is his concept, Kevin Casey, writing an article on Global Comment. I'd now like to hear your comments. I'd like for you to give us a call. On our talkback number is 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. You never hear this discussed, and I believe we should have everything on the table to discuss. Let me also mention that we don't know what the future will be for our beloved WBAI, where I've been for 45 years, and for all the producers and the hosts and the people who've helped, volunteers, who've kept the station alive when, for all intents and purposes, because, in my opinion, it has been because of mismanagement, poor programming, and most importantly, bad advice and power politics and internecine conflicts within this local station board. The different identity politics group have taken control at different times in the life of the station and alienated the audience, priding themselves in who they don't want to have listen to the pure ideology. And if you're not good enough, then you shouldn't listen, without realizing that to have a successful radio station, you actually have to have people who have had success in non-commercial radio and in non-profit foundations, something we're sorely lacking. So I believe that the wound has been inflicted and probably will, over the next 3 to 6 months, be fatal. We will do all we can to have a backup system in support of continuing on the voices of BAI, whether it's local programming only, whatever it takes a form of, we will certainly do all that's possible. But there's a reality that's going to be hitting us in the near future when other stations are failing miserably and they don't want to keep bailing BAI out because they can't even bail themselves out. So the coup worked, not because they were able to come in and close us down and take it over. It's because they came in, closed us down, and then knew that it would take enough time to go to court where we'd finally win and come back on the air. But it was a devastating financial and audience killer for us. We will continue to struggle as we can, but take down this number, because you never know when you turn it on. It may not be there. It happened before. And we had over 1,000 people from my audience call and say, "What happened to Gary?" Well, take this number down, and therefore you'll know that no matter what happens, we'll be here, and we'll help as many people from the BAI as possible. Here's the number. You can always call every day and live noon to 1. Write it down, please. 774-337-6068. 774-337-6068. And as of our next program, I'm going to start answering your questions again. And that voicemail where you can ask questions or make comments, and a lot of people listen to the show on archives, so therefore they'll have a question when we're not live on the air. So this way you can call and ask a question or make a statement. 862-800-6805. 862-800-6805. I'm going to try to take between 3 to 5 listener calls per day. And our archive number, 701-719-9976. 701-719-9976. Now we're going to go to a clip. And I'm changing the order because for those of you who think that all these vaccines are safe and effective and that the government wouldn't intentionally do anything to harm us, wow, how naive. This is a leaked Pentagon video, flu vaccine used to modify human behavior. You can watch this also. If you want to watch this, you can go to youtube.com. That's youtube.com/PRNFM. youtube.com/PRNFM.
We have individuals who are religious fundamentalists, religious fanatics, and this is the expression, RT-PCR, real-time PCR expression of the VMAT2 gene. Over here, we have individuals. So let me complete. So over here, we have individuals who are not particularly fundamentalists, not particularly religious, and you can see there's a much reduced expression of this particular gene, the VMAT2 gene. Another evidence that supports our hypothesis for the development of this approach.
By spreading this virus, we're going to eliminate individuals from donning on a bomb vest and going into a market and blowing up the market.
So our hypothesis is that these are fanatical people, that they have overexpression of the VMAT2 gene, and that by vaccinating them against this, we'll eliminate this behavior. So we have some very, very remarkable data in this next slide. Here we have two brain scans. These are fMRIs. These are two different individuals with different levels of expression of VMAT2. On top is an individual who's a religious fanatic, and individual, and we've repeated this numerous times, that has high levels of VMAT2. Now, this individual down here, who had low levels of the VMAT2 gene, this individual would self-describe as not particularly religious. In each case, these individuals were read a religious text. This individual lit up the right middle frontal gyrus, shown here, and that's a part of the brain that's associated with theory of mind. It's a part of the brain that has to do with intents and beliefs and desires. In marked contrast, here's an individual who would not particularly self-describe as religious, and when they're read a religious text, what you see is that this part of the brain called the anterior insula lights up. This is a part of the brain that's associated with disgust or displeasure on hearing something.
Are you suggesting I take a CT scan with me when I'm evaluating people to determine whether I put a bullet in their head?
So the data that I'm presenting here supports the concept that we're proposing, and I think that we would not propose to do CT scans or fMRIs on individuals out in the hinterlands of Afghanistan. The virus would immunize against this VMAT2 gene, and that would have the effect that you see here, which is it's essentially to turn a fanatic into a normal person. And we think that will have major effects in the Middle East.
How would you suggest that this is going to be dispersed, the aerosol?
Well, so the present plan and the tests that we've done so far have used respiratory viruses, such as flu or rhinoviruses, and we believe that that's a satisfactory way to get the exposure of the largest part of the population. Most of us, of course, have been exposed to both of those viruses, and we're quite confident that this will be a very successful approach.
This is fascinating. What's the name of this proposal?
Yeah, so the name of this project is FunVax, which is the vaccine for religious fundamentalism.
And you have a proposal already?
The proposal has just been submitted, and I think that the data that I have shown you today would support the development of this project, and we think it has great promise.
Okay. Now, if this were Monty Python, and you could accept it as pure parody. Just remember what you just listened to. Now, let's go over, and we have people calling in. Let's start with Cynthia from New York. Hi, Cynthia. Your turn. Your comments, please.
Yes, I enjoyed the commentary. I agreed with some of it in terms of the waste that we all produce. But there are some aspects that I don't agree with at all. I remember you're talking about, I think it was you and that guy from Texas, talking about if every person alive were in Texas, they would get 1,000 square feet each or something like that. So it's not the population per se. It is the way that we have been entrained to live in this society and in the world society. And when he's talking about, if he is talking about sustaining the way we live now, then there is a problem with overpopulation. But if you're talking about changing the way we do things, I don't see there would be a problem. For example, you talk about the plastics and the ocean. If we had water that was pure, there would be no need to go to the store and buy plastic bottles. If there were other ways of distributing liquids, we wouldn't need the plastic bottles. There are all kinds of things that we do as a society, and we don't even have a choice about it. There have been many inventions that would give us free energy, for example, and they've all been stifled and stuffed and snuffed. And there's one, I think it's geothermal energy, that is available for us, but it's not promoted by the powers that be.
Okay. You've made some very valid points, Cynthia, and I thank you for calling in and making them. I will just look at a few of the comments you made to share a broader perspective. When you look at how much pollution occurs in the waters and how the largest plastic patch in the world is three times the size of Texas and it's in the Pacific Ocean, and you have billions upon billions of aquatic species that are strangled or killed because of that, you have a couple choices. You've heard me mention Occam's razor, the 14th century philosopher, and I've also mentioned a concept that I said, never confuse the complexity of a problem with the simplicity of its solution or its answer. So if you say people shouldn't be drinking plastic, they shouldn't. I agree. We over-plasticize everything, but it's the group of people who said that everything has to have plastic in order to have a consumer protection factor. So once something is created, it becomes very difficult to uncreate it. When you propagandize to people they should be eating meat, and you're showing it in every commercial, and especially on the weekend, on Sundays, everything is beer and beef, beer and, you know, fried chicken, then it's not just a matter of passing a law, because you can't decommission someone's epigenetic conditioning overnight. It generally takes up to 30 years to reverse patterns. Even in medicine, when something's been shown not to work and actually be harmful, it could take up to 33 years to reverse that. So we're not going to change on a dime, but right now, if we don't change, and if we don't change immediately, then within the next 5 years, we will not be able to change. In fact, I'm writing a new article. It'll be out in about 5 days, talking about the tipping points, because just today, Nature Magazine's been distributing the newest article on the tipping points. So you haven't heard about tipping points. On this program you have, but not elsewhere. Now we're at those tipping points. Wouldn't have been easier when children were young. Every single school promoted in the world, here's where we get our water, here's where water should come from, here's how we can use sanitation, here's why we shouldn't throw anything away that will end up in the ocean or clogging a river or on a beach. So we lack a universal educational program. On the other hand, the more educated people become, the fewer children they have. So, for example, in the United States and Great Britain, we had the fewest children, Germany the same way, but in sub-Sahara Africa, we had the most children. But the people living in sub-Sahara Africa used the least resources and therefore had the lowest carbon footprint. So if the problem is starting to look at how we can stop global warming, it's not about having fewer kids. It's because we create more pollution and we have more demands for more things that are finite with smaller families, but a greater carbon footprint, 1,000 times bigger than people living with humble means. And so we've gotten that part of the equation wrong. We equate people who are poor as being ignorant, therefore incapable of learning. And that's not true. The governments don't care. In India, the largest so-called democracy in the world, but it's just as corrupt as ours. There's violence right now in Kashmir, because what you have is you have a fascist. You have a Donald Trump, the heads of Modi, who has the Indian Hindus groups. But where is the energy going to educate people about sustainable farming? There isn't. What about keeping people in the country and giving them the resources? They can use the resources and make them renewable. There isn't. So when poor people can't feed themselves and don't have water, they migrate to the cities. Then they become slum citizens that are denied even basic access to hygiene, hospitals, food, etc. So we have to pull back far enough from our problem to realize technology is not the answer. It is far more important than that. If you have clean energy, someone's going to exploit it. If you have free energy, which we've had in the past, someone will buy the patent, like a car that can run off water. We had one. Patent was bought. You never heard another thing about it. So today, the only way that people can enjoy something is if it's shared in the common. But we don't appreciate the common anymore. Everything is proprietary. Everything is about me. But human nature, even at the genetic level, shows that we were born as a species. The Homo sapiens were born to cooperate. That's how they survive, not to compete. That's how one survives at the cost of the other. And hence you have this division of those who have an education or have the means to do something with their life. And the very first thing most, not all, but most careers and educated people do is they start enhancing their own self-esteem. They eat more meat. they spend more on clothes, on extras of life, lifestyles, and without any thought that, is this sustainable? They don't care about sustainability. So we need a complete reevaluation of everything that we do. Otherwise, we end up joining a protest, but while we're in the protest, we're eating McDonald's, drinking a Coca-Cola, wearing Tommy Hilfiger jeans, wearing jeans that might have been made in Bangladesh from slave labor. But we're at a protest. Well, then what good is the protest if we are not the change? So I would expand on your thoughts with those. Thank you very much, Cynthia. Let's say hello to BJ from New York. You're on.
Hi, Gary.
Hi.
Hello?
You're on the air.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, thanks. So I appreciated your playing, I guess his name was Kevin Casey's remarks.
Yes.
And I definitely agree with most of them. I guess I got to thinking after Cynthia's call about population increase itself being the problem and wondered about your thoughts with regard to the distribution of resources, if that isn't also a part of the problem, maybe not the main part, I'm not sure. And I thought I also read somewhere that with agriculture and the increase in food production to where the people producing the food were producing more than they needed and therefore could send it to market, that also seemed to be followed by population growth, so that the amount of food produced never was sufficient to feed the entire world population, regardless of distribution, simply because of the fact that the population would increase, I guess, at a rate that exceeded the increase in the food production. And I'd be interested in your comments about that.
Okay. Well, first off, theoretically, as a theoretical model, we could grow enough food for about 9 to 10 billion people. Our problem is the system that it's grown under, capitalism, and especially vulture capitalism or proprietary capitalism, not ethical capitalism, in which case food will be grown, but only for exploiting the highest profit, and those who are the poorest cannot give you the profit, and as a result, they're denied the advantage of the distribution of those food resources. We also have mono farming, industrial farming. That is not sustainable. But organic, biodegradable, biologic farming is sustainable, and hydroponic is sustainable and will be the needed for the future. But also look at China. China is now approaching, will have the largest population in the world, and it's got the largest number of educated people. And the very first thing they wanted in the last 2 years is a 300% increase in meat. That means that the population and what they desire with their new status of education and income production is they want the advantages we have taken for granted here and we think are the exemplary way of showing our standard of living. So that's unsustainable. So where is the government of China? Where is the government of the United States? Where is the government of Canada? Where is the government of India and Brazil telling people, go to a plant-based diet? Break up the large industrial farms, have small farms, and support that with public subsidies. There should be a bill in Congress where we used to have 40 acres and a mule, give 100 acres and help support building farms for people who want to go and live on them, where they get the farm for free as long as they live there and give one-third of the food that they produce to local communities for free to feed the poor and the homeless. If you did that, then we wouldn't have anyone hungry and they'd be eating good, healthy food year-round. But you see, that's what happens when nothing works because nothing's interconnected. They've lost the guide. They've lost the interconnectedness of all things. I appreciate both of your comments. We're out of time. But thank you very much. I look forward to having more comments and feedback on upcoming programs. I'm Gary Nall, and have a very nice day.